I'd like to begin our discussion, Parshas Pinchas, this evening by referring to a Rashi in Parshas Vayechi. And the reason why is because, as we will see, in one form or another, the roots of the beginning of Parshas Pinchas, and of course Parshas Pinchas really is a follow-on from the end of Parshas Balak, the roots of all of this are already referred to in the end of Chumash Bereishis. And let us see how that is. Parshas Vayechi contains as its centerpiece, shall we say, the brachos that Yaakov gives to the Shvatim, to the brothers. Now, some of the brachos don't sound overtly like brachos, but ultimately they all are. And numbers 2 and 3 are dealt with together. They are Shimon and Levi. Shimon v'Levi, Achim, and that's about the last thing that sounds positive in that bracha. From then onwards, it's very critical. Klei chomos mecheru sehem, aro apam ki oz. And at a certain point, this is in Bereishis Perek Memtes, Pasuk Vav, we'll read the Pasuk and then take a look at what Rashi says. Besodom al tovo nafshi. May my soul not come in their council, shall we say. Bikohalom, in their assembly, al techat kavodi. May my honor not be connected or unified. Why? Here is Yaakov disassociating himself from Shimon and Levi. Why is that? Kiva apam hargu ishpor, in their fury, they killed a man, uvertzonam ikushor, and through their will they sought to uproot the disable the ox. Okay, who is the ish? Who is the ox? The ish are the people of Shechem, and the ox is Yosef. Shimon and Levi collaborated on these two projects. Number one, the destruction of Shechem, Bayikach, Shimon v'Levi achedina, ish chabo. That was the first. And their second endeavor was they were, according to Chazal, according to our tradition, the prime protagonist behind the sale of Yosef, or initially worse than that. Vayomu ish el achiv, and ish el achiv always is a connotation to Shimon and Levi. And therefore, these are the two wrongdoings. In Yaakov's eyes, certainly the way that they were done, without a doubt, and what happened with Shechem, what happened with Yosef, and therefore says Yaakov, so I don't want any part in what they will be involved with, even further on down the line. Even Maase Zimri, even Maase Korach. For as Rashi will tell us, when Yaakov says, Besodom al tovo nafshi, let my soul not come in their counsel, that is a reference to Maase Zimri, to the act of Zimri. Bikohalom al techat kavodi, the gathering, the assembly that Yaakov wishes to be detached from, is the gathering of Korach, Vayikach Korach, Vayikohalu al Moshe v'al Aharon. And therefore, even at this stage, if we just see how the Pasuk looks, it's as follows. Yaakov says, I do not wish to be associated not with what happens with Zimri and not with Korach because of what they did with Shechem and because of what they did with Yosef. That's, if we look at it through that lens, that's the run of the pasuk. And we need to understand what exactly is the connection between these Shnayim Shein Arba, these two entities that split up into entity plus episode. It is true, of course, that Zimri and Korach are from Shimon and Levi. Zimri is the Nasi of Shimon. Korach, as we know, is from Levi. But somehow the Pasuk seems to be more specific than that. Somehow it seems that because of what happened with Shechem, and because of what happened with Yosef, that is why Yaakov does not wish to be associated. That's the simple translation of the Pasuk. Besodom al tavo nafshi. Bekalam al techat kavodi. And should you ask, well, why not? Why do you not wish to be connected to those endeavors? The answer is because of look at what happened with Shechem and look at what happened with Yosef. And of course, our question is, why would one need those precedents as explanations for why Yaakov doesn't want any part of not Maisa Zimri and not Maisa Korach? Maisa Zimri is bad enough by itself. Maisa Korach is bad enough by itself. Even if you'd never heard not of Shechem and not of Yosef, we would still well understand the evil that exists within what happened with Zimri and what happened with Korach. And that being the case, how do they come to form the explanation? This is what's so insidious. And this is what is so troublesome about Korach and Zimri. Because look at what happened with Yosef and with Shechem. Why do you need such background?
I think that Yaakov knew what happened.
On a certain level, that's right. That's right. As far as Rashi is concerned, for sure.
What could possibly be wrong with Shechem?
Let's let things... Now, let's now, with that background, having at least laid the foundations in that Rashi, come to the beginning of Parshas Pinchas. We see that the evaluation of Pinchas's act was not clear at all, was not apparent to everyone by any means. For as Rashi tells us, there were certain factions amongst the Jewish people who did not appreciate at all what Pinchas did. And this is what they said. Rashi quotes it. Hara'isim ben Puti zeh. Have you seen this? Ben Puti, why is he called Ben Puti? Because he's descended from Yisro. Shepitem agolim l'avodah zarah. Who fattened calves for avodah zarah. And look, here's the einikel. And what can you expect? The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And his grandfather was in avodah zarah. And here he is killing people. That was the column. Until HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself had to come and establish that Pinchas' act was a pure and correct act, and ultimately an act of kindness, because that was what saved the lives of all those Jewish people who would have been wiped out had the plague continued, as the Pasuk says. So not for the first time, the people on the street didn't get it right. But we do need to understand, what type of criticism is that? It really sounds like a very low shot at Pinchas. As if to say, no good can come of you. Look where you came from. Look at your grandfather. Everything he does will be judged accordingly. A person's actions need to be judged on their own merit. If it's a mitzvah, it's a mitzvah. A person who's descended from a rasha is incapable of doing good? Is that the moral of the story? Is Pinchas not known? Let us rewind prior to today, where things took a very drastic turn. Before today, he's not known as a righteous person. Pinchas is a tzaddik. All of a sudden, he's lost 100% of his credit. The truth is, the most complicated person here, most difficult to understand, is Zimri himself. Because if we just read the psukim at the end of last week's parsha, we will see that the entire episode of Zimri happened after the episode of Benos Moav. If we look at the psukim from the beginning of the perek there, so we will see that the story has practically finished before Zimri begins. Vayachal ha'am liznos el benos Moav. Vatikren alahem vayochlim zivcheim. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, anyone who's involved needs to be killed. And that's it. Those are the first five psukim of Perek Kafhei. And then, Pasuk Vav starts again. The whole thing begins. But it's finished. Pasuk Vav, v'hinei ish mibnei Yisrael ba'as. It's a new story. V'yakrev elachavis hamidyonis le'enei Moshe le'enei kol bnei Yisrael. Until Pinchas deals with him. And it's very important to notice this, because if we don't, then we won't appreciate at all what Zimri was doing. I think when we would summarize the story in our own words, we see Zimri as the leader of all of those who made a mistake, who did something wrong. But he's not at all. Every mistake that was to be made by everyone else has been made already and dealt with. And then Zimri begins. So you've had the crime, you've had the punishment, and then noch a crime? But then the question is, well, how could Zimri possibly think that he would get away with it, having seen, according to Chazal, thousands and thousands of people having been executed for what he's about to do? That said, we do need to ask another question. And that is, if we've seen that this has already happened, the story has happened, everyone who was involved was killed by a Beis Din. And the only one who wasn't is Zimri, who's killed by Pinchas. And everyone, there's an uproar, and no one knows why Pinchas did it. And the question is, how is Zimri any different than the other thousands of people who were killed by a Beis Din? And Zimri opens up the whole thing again, and apparently the Beis Din doesn't go near him until Pinchas does, and no one knows why. So what is clear from these, just reading the Psukim, is that what happened with Zimri was not a mere rehash. He was not number 88,001 of the episode of Benos Moav. And this is a question which is discussed by the Chasam Sofer, and he gives an entirely new vision, new insight into what is this episode called Maaseh Zimri. Now, it seems clear that the very fabric of what he did is very different than everyone else. And the root of the matter is in Pasuk Vav. Let us see Pasuk Vav again. We're in the end of Parshas Balak. We will get Bli Neder to Parshas Pinchas at some stage. But V'hinei ish mibnei Yisrael ba. Okay. He's not named, by the way, yet. V'yakrev elechav es hamidyonis. He brings the Midianis close to his brothers. That is a very obscure expression. What does it mean? What does it signify? Says the Chasam Sofer, these words, Vayakrev Elechav Es HaMidianis, are the key to understanding Maaseh Zimri. And the reason is because this is what sets his act in contrast to everyone else. The Pasuk could not be clearer about the earlier encounters with Benos Moav / Midian. The Pasuk says, in the beginning of the Perek, Vayeshev Yisrael b'shitim, Vayachel ha'am liznos el Benos Moav. There is very little covered up here. There is very little that it could be misunderstood here. However it happened, the Pasuk is very explicit about it. They entered into Znus, they went towards Benos Moav, and there was Avodah Zarah, and it was a disaster. Zimri does something else. Whereas everyone else went from the camp of Israel, El Benos Moav, which is clear-cut Znus, Zimri took someone from Midian and brought her into the camp of Israel. Vayakrev El Echav, he brought her close to his brothers. And what does that mean? It means, says Chasam Sofer, he did not present this as an act of consorting with a non-Jewess at all, with the Midianites at all, but rather he preceded his relationship with her by bringing her into the fold. He converted her to Judaism. Vayakrev El Echav. Now, the truth is that this is probably one of the only ways to understand a comment that Rashi makes, we all know it, where that Pasuk, back again, Pasuk Vav, Vayakrev Elechav Es HaMidyanis, he brings her close to his brothers, Le'enei Moshe, in the sight of Moshe. What does that mean, in the sight of Moshe? Rashi says, he brought her to Moshe. I mean, this was a confrontation. And he said, is she mutter or osser? And should you say that she's osser because, you know, she's from Midian? So what about your wife? Your wife, the daughter of Yisro, Tzipora, is also from Midian. So how can you can marry her and I can't marry her? And that was that. No one knew what to do. Says the Chasam Sofer, if you don't mind me asking, does no one have a response to that? We could respond to that. There's a world of difference between the two. Everybody starts somewhere, but at the critical point, Tzipora, like everybody else, became Jewish. Is that not reasonable? So if she, regardless of where she came from, she's Jewish now, that's why we're married. And this woman is not. So why is it such a checkmate question? The answer, says Chasam Sofer, is it's not so clear at all. We see from here that Zimri has a response to that. What will you say? Tzipora converted. Well, guess what? So did she. So now what will you say? Who told you that the conversion of your wife was good and the conversion of my wife is no good? That's very difficult. There's no book that will provide the answer to that question. And that is why everyone is stuck. The only one who takes action here is Pinchas. That to understand the measure of what Pinchas is doing, essentially he is acting in response to what he considers to be a travesty of the conversion process. Because it is using it as a smokescreen in order to permit what everybody knows, if only one person is prepared to say it, that this woman has no interest at all in being Jewish. And if that's true, then add to the crime of Znus a perversion of the law, a hijacking of the concept of conversion and mocking it. And Pinchas takes action. Now, what's very interesting is, just to understand in this way, it's a very new insight into it. It's much more complicated than just no one really knows what to do and the only one who had a sword nearby was a spear, Pinchas. It's complicated. And the truth is, says the Chasam Sofer, this will give us added insight as to why people were so critical of Pinchas. What did they say? We quoted the Rashi before. They said, Haraisim em putize. You see, Pinchas, look at his grandfather. His grandfather fattened calves for Avodah Zarah. And he went and killed Zimri. So how do we understand what exactly is that criticism? Apart from bringing up the whole family history. What does it mean? So the simple understanding is that what they're saying is like grandfather, like grandson. He was no good and he was no good. Is that? You're so quick to judge? Says the Chasam Sofer, no. They actually meant the opposite. For what they're saying is, look at Pinchas. Pinchas was so quick to condemn her because of her background. You see, apparently, as far as Pinchas is concerned, there's no hope for anyone if they come from bad stock. So once a Midianite, always a Midianite, and that's why he didn't give her a chance. But of all people, Pinchas should do that? Pinchas himself is a glowing example of how high a person can rise from humble origins. Look at him, he is the ultimate success story. His grandfather was fattening calves for Avodah Zarah, and he's the biggest tzaddik in the world. We all agree. So he should have known that you can't judge a person by their background. And that's exactly what he did. That was the nature of their criticism, our Isib and Putizeh. It's much more under the surface here. And what's interesting is, if that is the case, and Ad Kan from the Chasam Sofer, then perhaps, what is the response to that? Ultimately, it is a question that only HaKadosh Baruch Hu can answer. Definitively. Because if you can argue all day as to whether the conversion was good or wasn't good, and whether Pinchas should have taken action or shouldn't have taken action, That's an argument that can go on ad infinitum until HaKadosh Baruch Hu says Pinchas was right. He judged correctly that the conversion was a sham, and his nus ultimately was no different than everybody else who had been executed that day. The way it's done is by being miyaches Pinchas back to Aaron. That's really how it starts. You're saying he came from Yisro. I'm saying this act came from Aaron. And what does that mean? How does identifying Pinchas as the grandson of Aaron help us in any way? So perhaps one of the qualities that we know about Aaron is that he was able to assess the essence of a person. That is why he had a certain talent for attracting people and communicating with them, making shalom between them, oev shalom v'rodev shalom, oev sabrios and mekarva na Torah, as the Mefarshim say, because Aaron had this knack of being able to tap into the inner essence of the person. He himself was absolutely suited to the job of the Kohen Gadol, whose job is to go lifnai v'lifnim, inside the inside. As surely as he did that in the Beis HaMikdash, he was able to do that with regard to the people. He was able to get inside the inside of a person. So he knew what was bothering them. He knew what was off-putting to them. He knew what was stopping them and in their altercations with their fellow man, and was able to diffuse it and deal with it. This quality of lifnai v'lifnim was what was necessary for Pinchas, because he had to judge, he had to make a lifnai v'lifnim judgment in order to ascertain that this is a sham, this is a hoax, this whole vayakrev osa el achav. It is adding insult to injury, the insult of mocking halacha to the injury of good old-fashioned nus. And now, let us see what this has to do with Shechem. Shechem itself is a very complicated episode. And we see that Yaakov himself, as he criticizes not absolutely or categorically the act itself, but rather the way that it was done. And therefore it's a very mixed episode. Aror Apam, he says. He curses the anger of Shimon Velevi, not the act itself, as the Mefarshim point out. But what is it that we see here in the act of Shechem, if essentially it was the correct thing to do? How does it form the ultimate condemnation of Maase Zimri? Says Rabbi Yonasan Eibershitz, something very interesting happened. How did, in the episode of Shechem? Well, if we would describe it in one sentence, Shimon and Levi came in and destroyed and killed everyone. How did they do that? Because they were weak from their milah. Why are they doing milah? Because they were told by Shimon and Levi that if you do milah, you can become like us. And then we'll be one big happy family. And the very same people that told them to do that proceeded to kill them because they were holding Dina hostage. But let's ask a she'elas tam. How can you kill them? They're Jewish, aren't they? You said so yourself. You said, if you want to be like us, do the milah, then you'll be like us, and then you're Jewish, and then it'll be fine. What is the obvious response? They're not Jewish. But they converted. What's the answer? There's no conversion. Ah. That is the basis of the plan of Shimon and Levi. It is based on the understanding that if it's an external going through the motions of conversion with no inner conviction whatsoever to become part of the Jewish people, it is worthless, says Yaakov. Having established that, that is what makes Maase Zimri all the more objectionable. Besodom al tava nafshi, after what happened with Shechem, where you yourself used a false conversion and then ignored it, because you understood that it means nothing. Not every motion of conversion is actually valid. You understood that full well. So then, should you, on whatever level Yaakov already has knowledge of what will happen, or an inkling of what will happen with Maase Zimri, and that's going to be the basis of Zimri's whole platform, says Yaakov, I don't want any part of it. So that's called learning Rashi. Besodom al tovo nafshi, because Ba'apam hargu ish. One is the indictment of the other. They have already laid the basis of the undoing of the later episode of Ma'ase Zimri. And by the way, for the sake of Hashlama, when we come to the second part of the pasuk, which is Bikahala Maltechal Kavodi, in their assembly, let me not be attached. Why? So that second future episode is rooted in the second past episode, Uvritzonom Ikru Shor, because of what they did to Yosef. As we know from Rishonim and Achronim, the violence of the and the definacy of the act of the brothers against Yosef is because they saw him as pulling away from the rest of the brothers at their expense, that only he should be the one who really carries on the legacy of Yaakov and everyone else will be left behind. They saw him as a rodef in that respect.
Didn't Yaakov realize that in the episode of Zimri, Levi actually represented by Pinchas divided from...
Levi did. It's an...
From Shimon.
Correct. That's the redemption of Levi, right? But Shimon remains objectionable in that respect. So that's Shimon's dark time, and Levi's is Korah. And why? Because, as we've mentioned on a number of occasions, ultimately, as much as Korah presents himself as representing the people, he is looking to pull away from the people. Because his main platform is, why should the Avodah be taken away from us? We all heard Na'aseh v'nishma. He's using the unity of the Jewish people as his platform, but the truth is, once again, the answer is agonizingly simple. You all heard Anochi Hashem Elokecha at Har Sinai, and then you all made the ego. So things have changed. Why is that not so simple? Because Korach is a Levi, and Levi weren't involved in the ego. Ve'asfu alav kol b'nei Levi. So they're clean. They're untainted by the Egel. And that's why ultimately Moshe remonstrates at length with Shevet Levi. Is it not enough for you that you've already been separated to a certain degree? Uvikashtem gam kahuna? Who said anything about Levi? The answer is Moshe understands instantly that it's about Levi. Korach will jettison the rest of the Jewish people at the appropriate time because Levi are the only ones who weren't involved in the Egel. And therefore, says Rabbi Yonos and Ivershutz, Bekahalam al techad kavodi, what is all the more repugnant about the episode of Ma'aseh Korach is that Ma'aseh Korach will involve Levi trying to do the very thing that the original Levi reacted so badly when he thought Yosef was trying to do. He thought Yosef was trying to pull ahead. What about the rest of us? Says Yaakov. So when you Korach come to pull ahead, what about the rest of them? Ubetzonam okrusho. So that is a very... I believe, thought-provoking understanding of the Rashi, and perhaps let's move on at this point.
Like Bernstein, the Torah justifies what Pinchas did, definitely. Why didn't Pinchas do it in the beginning? It could have saved so many lives. There was a Magefa. Thousands of people died. Had he done what he did with Zimri at the end, why didn't he do it beforehand?
The chronology of events, I think, really has to be worked through in terms of the psukim. It sounds like he did what he did as soon as he could, as far as the psukim are concerned. That's the amount of time it took him to act. I'm not sure he acted any later than he could have. I don't know what's later and what's before. I'm not sure what the time frame is. That's an imponderable for us. Zimri himself has another name as far as Chazal are concerned. And that we will find, for we have one of the countings here in Parshas Pinchas, and every family of every Shevet is mentioned. And when we come to Shevet Shimon, there's a family called Mishpachas HaShauli. L'Shaul Mishpachas HaShauli, and that's in Perek Kafvav, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Shauli. No need to trust me. Perek Kafvav, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Yes. Who is Shaul? Well, the Gemara says in Masechet Sanhedrin, Daf Pei Beis, that Sheol, we should know, is none other than Zimri. Sometimes the Torah gives a certain pseudonym for a person in order to characterize what they did. And the pseudonym for Zimri is Sheol. And why is he called Sheol? Shehishil atmo l'avodah zarah. He lent himself out to avodah zarah. Now, once we are aware of this piece of information, a very interesting shaila surfaces. Because there was someone later on who came from good stock, and his name was Sheol. And many Mefarshim are moved to ask, for as we know, the Talmud tells us in Maseches Yuma, Daf Lamed Ches Amud Beis, that based on the pasuk in Mishlei, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, the Zech, the mentioning, the remembrance of a Tzadik is always a good thing, V'shem Reshoim Yirkav, the name of the Rosh should rot. And one of the applications of that is that you don't give a child the name of a Rosh, as we know. That being the case, so the Mefarshim asked, what got into the father of Sheol to call him Sheol? Once we understand, if we have this tradition, presumably they had the same tradition, that Sheol is actually a reference to Zimri. So what type of a name is that for a Jewish boy? That's the shaila. Now, interestingly, there are a number of answers to this question. It starts actually before Sheol, because in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, Shmuel Aleph, so we have the naming of Shmuel, and the Pasuk says, in Perek Aleph Pasuk Kaf, his mother, Chana, called him Shmuel, it's Haftarah for the first day of Rosh Hashanah, Vatikra es Shemo Shmuel, Ki Me Hashem She'iltiv. She called him Shmuel because she asked him of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Me Hashem She'iltiv. So Mefarshim have an interesting shaila. Rishonim have an interesting shaila. You asked of him of Hashem, Me Hashem She'iltiv. So where did the mem come from? Why didn't you call him Sheol? That's a better fit. Sheol Me Hashem She'iltiv. And there are a number of responses to this question. The Ralbag gives a very balabatish teretz. Ralbag says you should know that when it comes to naming people after events, there is a certain connection, but don't expect every letter to be accounted for. Ein ledakdek. The Ralbag clearly was not of Yekish descent, which we know to be true in any case. And the Ralbag says, "Ein ledaktik," because you get the general idea. And if she likes the name Shmuel, and it's close enough to Sheol, so that's not a kasha. And says the Ralbag, "I'll prove it to you." Because very early on, one of the first people whose name was given with an explanation is Noach, in the end of Parshas Bereishis. His father gave him his begat, and Vayikra Shemo Noach. Lemor to say ze yenachamenu mimaseinu umietzvon yadenu. So that's why he's called Noach after the word yenachamenu. Says the Ralbag, the word yenachamenu is from the word nechama. So his name really should have been not Noach but Menachem or Nochum. Where did the mem go? Yenachamenu. Ralbag here disputing Rashi, who says that Yenachamenu is Yaniach Mimenu. He's pushing the mem out of the root, says that the root is Yaniach for Noach. But as far as the Ralbag is concerned, no, Yenachamenu, it's what it sounds like it means. He'll comfort us. So if he'll comfort you, so give him the full name, Nachum or Menachem. So you see, says the Ralbag, Ein Ledaktik. So if Noach can be Menachem, and Sheol can be Shmuel, and don't worry about it. The Radak, interestingly, another of the Rishonim, is also discussing the question of why is he called Shmuel? Where did the mem come from? And the Radak gives a very interesting answer. He says that Chana, if we look closely at her words, she called him Sheol, ki me'eis Hashem she'iltiv. Me Hashem she'iltiv. So the profile of this child is that he's Sheol, Me Hashem. Now, Shaul, the Aleph and Lamed of Shaul is also Kael, ultimately that would be. And therefore, says the Radak, she integrated a mem into his name, so that actually the shin is connected to the el because it's Shaul, but the mem is connected because he is Shaul Mekael Shemuel. It's a synthesized name, Me Hashem She'il Tiv. That's why he's Shemuel and not Shaul. So these are Rishonim. It's interesting. I don't think we normally think about this on the Haftarah and Rosh Hashanah morning, but it's part of the pasuk. We need to look at it. But the Chasam Sofer, in his drashas, also talks about this, and he gives a very different response, and says, if the question is why did she call him Shmuel, and not Shaul? Wouldn't Shaul be the intuitive name? The answer, says Chasam Sofer, yes, it would be an intuitive name. But it's not a name you want to call your child, because the original Shaul was Zimri. And therefore, whereas the Ralbag is saying it's approximately the same thing, and the Radak is saying it has another message, says the Chasam Sofer, maybe it's not exactly the same. Better to be not exactly the same than to be exactly a problematic name, like Shaul. And moreover, and one needs the shoulders of the Chasam Sofer to finish a sentence, which is that a short while later on, someone else had a child, and he called him Shaul, and look what happened. Ure'ema olsolo, says Chasam Sofer. Shaul ben Kish, his father was happy to call him Shaul, says Chasam Sofer. Difficult to quantify, but that's not a name that bodes well for a Jewish person. And we should know that this is not the first time the Chasam Sofer has said this, because in Parshas Korach, and of course, Korach, by no standards, ended up well at all, says Chasam Sofer. In addition to everything else, look at the roots of the name Korach. Korach is not the first person in the Torah to be called Korach. The original Korach is in the end of Parshas Vayishlach. He's one of the chieftains of Esav. Aluf Korach. He's right there with Aluf, all the others. Amalek. And everyone else. Eliphaz. And Korach. Says Chasam Sofer, it didn't help. Call your child Korach. And didn't help Shaul to be called Shaul. Ad kedei kach. So we see that the Chasam Sofer really does embrace very much this notion that based on the history of the name Shaul, it's not a name that should have been given. Chana strove to avoid it. And the one who didn't strive to avoid it possibly paid for it. For Shaul, I don't know. Let's broaden a little bit. Interestingly, another answer to this question. It's from one of the contemporaries of the Chasam Sofer, and his name is Rabbi Yehuda Asad, Mahari Asad. And he says a very interesting thing. I think we'll begin to take notice of all sorts of names that were just in the woodwork prior to this. But first of all, let us assert as something reasonable that if you have a name that was once patronized by someone who was a Rosha, he cannot derail a name for all future generations. In other words, let us say there was a Rosha called Moshe. And by the way, there have been. So no one should call the child Moshe. And Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't go away. So no one can usurp a name and blacken it. If the only person you ever knew was a Rosha, and he was the one who had this name, so then it's the name of a Rosha. But if you have Tzadikim with a name, and Risharim with a name, I mean, that's it. They can hijack a name. Not so, says the Mari Asad. And that being the case, we should know that even Shaul, who is Zimri, is not the first Shaul in the Torah. I mean, really, we have to go back to Chumash Bereishis and start from the beginning again. But there is a Shaul, again, in the end of Parshas Vayishlach. And he is one of the seven kings of Edom. Now, we need to know that at that stage, all of those Malchi Edom are not associated with Esav. That fusion came later on. But there were seven generations of kings, or more correctly, seven reigns of kings that took place of Malchi Edom. And as far as the Medrash is concerned, those seven people were all tzaddikim. On the contrary, the Medrash says the reason why they were so successful in their reign is because they were very punctilious in the fulfillment of the Sheva Mitzvahs, Bnei Noach. And therefore, for what it's worth, and for who he was, the original Shaul is a tzaddik. Later on, there's a Shaul who brings discredit to that name, but he cannot sully it for posterity. And therefore, subsequently, if someone's going to be called Shaul, he has ample precedent with a worthy Shaul, someone worthy to carry that name. What's most interesting is this question has been discussed in our parsha by the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, Rabbi Chaim ben Atar. And Rabbi Chaim says, we should know that this principle, and it's important to think about it, because some people apparently are not aware of this. I'm not sure if you've met anyone called Nimrod or the like. Apparently this sugya was not discussed prior to the name, if it was thought about at all. But it's mentioned in the Gemara, Shem Risharim Yerkab, one should be careful the name they give to their child. Of course, as we know. Says the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, this notion, this concept, that we do not give a name to a child, that's the name of a Rasha, is only true if the person in question was a Rasha from beginning to end. But should it be the case that the person, as much as he may have lived as a Rasha, but his life ended in a positive way, then as surely as he himself has the status of a Baal Tshuva as a positive person, the name can be redeemed. Classic case in point is Yishmael. Now, again, I haven't heard many Yishmaels called up in Shul lately, but it was a name that was considered to be perfectly acceptable. Rabbi Yishmael, the Tana, it was a Kohen Gadol, and Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha, and there was a Sephardi tradition, even until relatively recently, that Yishmael was a name. When the relationships with the host countries were more benign, there was a Shelos and Shuvas Zera Emes, Rabbi Yishmael HaKohen. I mean, that's from the 1600s, 1700s. Because, as we know, Yishmael did Shuvah in the end, and the name was redeemed. And one can call it. It's actually a very nice name, Yishmael. What about Zimri? Because for Zimri is the one who is behind the name of Shaul. Says Or HaChaim HaKadosh, we never heard of anything about Zimri before. And before this episode. There was no question that something got into him. He made a terrible, terrible mistake. And he paid for it. However, says the Or HaChaim, we should know that ultimately whatever mistake he made was redeemed for by his death. At the end of the day, the execution of someone like Zimri is meant to be a tikkun for them. It's meant to be a rectification of what they did, if not fully, then partially. Says the Or HaChaim, if we look closely, and the Or HaChaim always beckons us to look closely at the psukim, we will see in the beginning of Parshas Pinchas, Pasuk Yud Dalet, V'shem Ish Yisrael. The name of Ish Yisrael. Ish Yisrael is an expression of kavod, right? It is an expression of chashivus. He is now called Ish Yisrael. Hamukeh, look closely at the Pasuk, V'shem Ish Yisrael Hamukeh, Asher Hu Kais Hamidyonis. The Pasuk has used the word Haka'ah, Mukeh, Asher Hu Ka, twice in a row, in order to emphasize that everything bad that happened to him was only as a result of what he did with the Midianis. He was mukeh, without a doubt. He was killed. Asher hu kares ha-Midianis, because of what happened with the Midianis. That's where it started. That's where it finished. And what's interesting is, we have no mention of his name when it actually happened. There's a person, he's not identified by name until now. And says the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, the reason why is because that is not, if one could say, it's an amazing thing. That's not him. That's not Zimri. That's not his name. His name will not feature the way he did. It was so out of character. It doesn't mean that he didn't pay for it. It doesn't mean that he didn't cause a great deal of damage and had to pay the full price for it. But the Torah doesn't give him his name until he's restored. And now, and here's the name Zimri bin Son. And in fact, says the Or HaChaim, this is perhaps even the intimation of the Gemara, because he's called Shaul. Why is he called Shaul? Shehish'il atzmo l'avodah zarah. What is the word hish'il? Lish'ol is to borrow He lent himself. When you lend something, it's temporary. It's not absolute. It was a temporary disaster, but it was not absolute. Hishil atzmo. And therefore, the final verdict on Zimri even, which is unexpected, I think, but if we look closely at the psukim, everyone, if they pay for their mistake, and they are not defined by their mistake, so then their name does not become blackened by it. Some people sell their souls to the devil, and some people lend them. Zimri hishil atzmo l'avodah zarah. So these are very interesting responses to the question that was generated by Zimri Zeshol. And from there, let's talk about happier matters and move on to the psukim of the korbanos. As we know, Parshas Pinchas contains within it the psukim of all of the regular korbanos, that is to say, the Parshas Atomid. This is how Perek Kavches begins, Parshas Atomid, and then the Musaf of Shabbos, and then the Musaf of the Yomim Tovim. Maftir of every Yom Tov always comes from Parshas Pinchas. Parshas Pinchas is my Bar Mitzvah Parsha. I was the most popular person in Shul on Yom Tov. Now, as we know, Maftir always is taken from this section. And that generates an interesting shaila amongst Rishonim. Tosfos asks this question. It's a special day, has special korbanos, you take out a special Sefer Torah, and talk about it. That's what you do in Rosh Chodesh, Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. So the Tosfos ask an interesting shaila. Why not Shabbos? Shabbos is also a special day. I think we all agree. Shabbos also has a korban musaf. No, it has tefillas musaf. And we talk about that. We mention those psukim in the course in the musaf. Uviyom haShabbos, Shnei Kavosim, Neshana Tamimim, etc. That's from Midrash Perek Kavches. So it's a rather unusual question because we're so used to it not being the case. But Tosfos asks the shaila. Why not take out a second Sefer Torah and read the Parsha of Musaf for Yom Tov? It's good enough for Chodesh, good enough for Yom Tov, good enough for Shabbos. And the Tosfos are very taken by this question. And three responses are forthcoming from the Tosfos. The first, and it's important to know, in fact, there is even a section of Shulchan Aruch where the sections have titles. The simonim of Shulchan Aruch have titles. Some of them are they are what the content is. Hilchos Bishul, Hilchos Borer, Hilchos Tfilin, Hilchos Tzitzis, etc. And there is a siman, a section in Shulchan Aruch. It has one si'if, one line in it. And the name of the section is Lama Ein Korin Parshas Musaf V'Kriyas HaTorah B'Shabbos. That's its name. The entire section is devoted to explaining this. It doesn't even sound like a halacha at all, because the halacha is you don't. And the section of Shulchan Aruch is, why not? And of course, that's all coming from Tosfos. The first answer of Tosfos is, we have a principle that the minimum amount that can justify an aliyah to the Torah is three psukim, and that's derived from its own sources, and that we know. There is no such thing as an aliyah with less than three psukim. The parsha of Musaf, of Shabbos, only has two psukim. Uviyom HaShabbos, Shnei Kavosim, Neshanu Tumimim, Shnei Esvenim, etc. That's the first pasuk. Ola Shabbos v'Shabbat, Ola Satomid v'Nisgot. So it's in Gansan, the whole thing is two psukim. So it doesn't justify an aliyah. What will you say, says the Tosfos, so maybe start to import from before, or maybe from afterwards, says Tosfos, that's got nothing to do with Shabbos anymore. So Shabbos alone is only two psukim, and therefore it's not enough to finance, so to speak, an aliyah to the Torah. Now, what's very interesting is, in case it's bothering you, because it bothered me, and I was happy to hear that it bothered people much greater than me, is that actually, on Rosh Chodesh, for example, we do incorporate into the laning things that are not yet Rosh Chodesh. We start with the Korban of the Talmud. As we know, that's how laning starts on Rosh Chodesh. It's Korbani, Lachmi, Le'ishai, Zakev Zachat HaSev HaBoker, Zakev Zashen HaSev Ben Abayim. And it's actually not until Revi that we talk about Rosh Chodesh at all. So the first three aliyahs are about every day and Shabbos. So why do Tosfos insist that you can't bring in other psukim that are not relevant to make up the bulk for the lane. This is a question of the Mordechai, one of the great Rishonim. However, the Bach explains in a very straightforward manner, but to be clear, these two are not analogous. In other words, as true as it is that we will on Rosh Chodesh bring in other days, and we'll start from the beginning of the Perek, it's not yet Rosh Chodesh, that's in order to make up the number of aliyahs. But the fourth aliyah, which was the special aliyah for Rosh Chodesh, is only about Rosh Chodesh. As opposed to here, where you've got the weekly parsha anyway, you don't need to make up the number of aliyahs. So to make a special aliyah out of Shabbos, where there's not enough psukim in Shabbos to justify it, that's already different. Machdir for Shabbos would have to be exclusively Shabbos, and it's only two psukim. The fourth aliyah on Rosh Chodesh, which is unique to Rosh Chodesh, that there's a revi, has five psukim, and they're all about Rosh Chodesh. That's the difference between. So that's the first answer of Tosfos. Moving on. Secondly, says Tosfos, the second reason why we do not bring out a second Sefer Torah somehow to read the Musaf of Shabbos is because the Maftir always dictates play for the Haftorah. Whenever you have a special Haftorah, it always begins with a unique Maftir. That's how every Maftir on Yom Tov will lead you to Yom Tov and the Arba Parshios, etc. And therefore, if every Maftir was about Shabbos, then every Haftorah would need to be about Shabbos, and you'd never have an Haftorah about anything else. You could never bring it back to the weekly Parsha. And that would undermine the entire institution of the Haftorah that's meant to somehow be connected thematically to the Parsha. And therefore, says the Tosfos, in order not to lock in the variety or the spectrum of what the Haftorah could be, because it would always have to be about Shabbos, so therefore we keep the Maftir open. Interestingly, there are a number of weeks where we have a special Maftir, a special Haftorah, even though the Maftir was unchanged. Shabbos Hagodol, regardless, there's no special Maftir for that, but there's a special Haftorah, as is the case for Shabbos Shuva and for Shabbos Chazon. But it seems there it's more that it's a special Haftorah, regardless of the fact that the Maftir wasn't the same. But if you have a special Maftir, there's going to have to be a Haftorah that's in kind, and that would always be Shabbos, and that, of course, is unacceptable. But finally, says the Tosfos, to understand why we don't read about Shabbos the way we read about Yom Tov in the Maftir, we need to look at what is reading about the Psukim of Maftir, the Korbanos in Maftir, all about. It is rooted in the Bris Ben HaBesorim, actually, because Avram asked, this is a Gemara in Megillah Daf Lamed Aleph and Tanis Daf Kaf Zayin, Avram Avinu asked, "Bamo'eido ki irashenu?" How do I know that I will inherit the land? That's a question that means many, many things. We're not going to talk about the whole thing now. But one of the aspects of what that means is, as plain and simple, how will the Jewish people, how do I know they'll be able to stay there, to sustain themselves there? The answer to that in the Pasuk was, Kach kecholi, bring me these animals. That's the answer in Bris Ben HaBesorim. And the reason why it's the answer is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, in the schus of the korbanos, they will be able to stay in Eretz Yisrael. And then Avram says, they're not going to always be in Eretz Yisrael. How will they survive without korbanos? And the answer to that is, even if they're in Golos and they cannot bring korbanos, but let them read about korbanos. Vanimale ki ilu hikrivum, I will consider it as if they offered their korbanos, u'mechaper lahem, and will atone for them. So what we see, and it's very important, because Maftir on Yom Tov, possibly, is a time when certain people begin to relax a little bit, and it's possibly underappreciated. But according to the Gemara, when we talk about the special musaf in the Maftir, that is what keeps us going. And the more korbanos we talk about on each time at its day, says the Tosfos, so we see that the reading of the korbanos has an element of kapara. And that is why it only happens on Yom Tov. Because Yom Tov is only Yom Tov that has a korban that brings kapara. Because every Yom Tov always carries within it the Seir Izim Lechatos. Every time. Shabbos, on the other hand, only has olos. Only has burnt offerings. And therefore, there is no element of kapara within the korbanos of Shabbos. And that is why, pardon the expression, It is not a burning issue in order to read about them on Shabbos, because we mention the Korbanos of Yom Tov because we need the kapara. The focal point is the Seir, lechaper alechem. Shabbos doesn't have a Seir, and therefore that kapara aspect isn't so critical, and that is why we don't need to read about the Musaf of Shabbos to the same degree that we would need to read about the Musaf of Yom Tov. What's interesting is the Tur, when he has the siman of why don't we read Musaf on Shabbos, or Rechaim Resh Pei Gimel, he says this is the explanation of something that we say in the Musaf of Shabbos. Tikanta Shabbos, Ratzisa Korbanoseha. You establish a Shabbos, you desired its korbanos. It's very interesting, if you never thought about it before. We don't say that on Yom Tov. Tikanta Yom Tov, or something happened, Ratzisa Korbanosov. Hashem doesn't want the korbanos of Yom Tov. Apparently he does. He commanded them in the Torah. So why is it that we only say Ratzisa Korbanoseha for Shabbos and not for Yom Tov? The answer, says the Tur, is because there is a certain beauty about the Korbanos of Shabbos, is that there is no negative association with them because they're not coming for Kapara. When Kapara is necessary, you have to do it, and the Torah tells you to do it. But Shabbos is not getting involved in that. There is a certain rotzon that accompanies the Korbanos of Shabbos because they're only olos. There's no seir. Just to mention, for the sake of Hashlama, again, the final answer to this question is not to be found in the Tosfos. Everything that we have just mentioned, if we could summarize the three answers of the Tosfos: number one, only to Psukim; number two, it would lock the Haftorah into Shabbos; and number three, it's not necessary because there's no Kapara. All of those three answers are to be found in the Tosfos on Maseches Megillah, Daf Kaf Gimel. But there is a fourth answer, and it's also coming from the Tosfos in their work on the Torah, Das Dekenim Mibalei HaTosfos. And there, the fourth answer is that there is a certain requirement of Yom Tov which is mentioned in the Torah. Eile Moadei Hashem, Mikroi Kodesh, Asher Tikru'u Osam B'Moadam. The Torah requires that Yom Tov needs to be literally called at its time. Now, says the Das Akenim, that can mean many things. And it does mean many things. Mikra Kodesh means many things. A holy calling, a holy convocation. But one of the things it means, says the Das Akenim, Ein Mikra Yose Mide Pshuto. The Pasuk that never fully escapes the simple meaning that you need to read about them at the day, on the day. That is said about Yom Tov, Asher Tikru'u Osam B'Moadam. Never said about Shabbos. And therefore, the Kriya of the Musafim exists on Yom Tov as a key issue, but there is no need to make an analogy between that and Shabbos and to ask, well, if we do it on Yom Tov, we should do it on Shabbos. Yom Tov has a mitzvah of Shetikru Osam B'Moadam as opposed to Shabbos. So these are the very interesting answers of the Baalei HaTosfos. And I would mention, just as a postscript, something that has been in my notes, had been burning a hole in my notes for the last 4 years, so Im Ein Achshav Emazai, and that is, apropos of the concept of the kapara on Yom Tov, because there's always a seir as a kapara. That is the uniform expression: seir izim lechatas, or seir lechatas lechaper alechem. With one exception, and that is Shavuos. When it comes to Shavuos, the Torah says useir izim echad lechaper alechem, but does not use the word chatos. And that's very interesting. V'ze omer darsheini. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Pesach, Sukkot, Seir Izim Lechatos. Rosh Hashanah, Shavuos, Seir Izim Lechaper Alechem. Why is that so? Well, as a prelude, we've mentioned many times, there is a question as to whether or not, when the Jewish people received the Torah and became Gerim themselves, were they considered to be starting from scratch, as the Ger does. Gershin is Gair, Kekotan Shenola Dami is considered to begin his entire life afresh, not related to anyone he's related to before. Is that true of the entire Jewish people? On this matter, there is a raging machlokas. The Maharal in the Gur Ari and Parshas Vayigash emphatically states, no, here it was different. They remained entirely related and connected to whoever they were before. The Meshech Chochma seems to be of the opinion, is of the opinion, that actually at Matan Torah, everyone was reset, and no one was related to anyone anymore. It's a discussion we've had on many occasions. How does it relate to us here? Because The words of Rabbeinu Bachya on our parsha, talking about Shavuos, says as follows. V'yesh lecha lehisboni, consider. Lama lo hizkir kan b'sa'ir shel atzeres. Why did it not mention within the context of the sa'ir of Shavuos, chatos, the word chatos, k'shem shehizkir b'chol ha'moedim shebeparsha zu, as it is mentioned with every other moed, v'hatam b'zeh al derech ha'pshat. Straightforward understanding is, v'fishatzeres man matan Torah. Shavuos is the time of the giving of the Torah. Listen to this. V'sham ha'yu Yisrael k'nolad zeh. Below chait. You see, the Jewish people at Shavuos time when they received the Torah, it's like they were just born. So they had no sins. And as a remembrance to that, whenever the Korban Chatos is never called by that name in Shavuos, because there is no Chatos in Shavuos. Because Shavuos is back to Matan Torah. Everyone starts from fresh. Now, this Rabbeinu Bachya could mean many things. But if we take it at its word, it seems to be a support for the Meshech Chochma. That Shavuos was a time that they were, in his words, Kanola de Belochet. We'll leave it over there for this evening.